This is going to be real informal, which means that the way I like to work informally is throw some ideas out, and at any point that people want to say, stop, let's explore what you said thus far, or what you said I'm not quite clear about, or, hey, I think you're wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, you can say that. So that's the way I like to work. And so the other thing is that I just keep talking until people interrupt. And so I'm very, very comfortable when people just interject right in the middle of a sentence even. So that's the way I like to work. I think it's always interesting to put things... Theology is a very personal task. You're always working out your own problems when you're trying to be a theologian. And in some sense... You hope that what is of importance to you is of importance to other people. But in another way, it doesn't matter as long as you work it out. I had a friend who went to seminary for a year, and once he got all his religious questions settled, he left.
In a year's time.
Good luck. Yeah. Well, he knew that there were still a lot of other questions to be, but he got his basic question, which was about God. And he went to Claremont, which is the hotbed of the theology that I work with, is from. Another thing about doing theology is that some of us are pragmatists, and some of us are not. I spent a part of my university career not being a pragmatist, so it took me a little longer to get through university than, because I was like the old joke Bill Cosby tells. People, I used to wander around and ask, why was there air, and why was there this? And Cosby said he always asked that question, but his wife was a phys ed major, and she knew what air was for, and it was to blow up volleyballs. So those are the two types of theologies, those of us who blow up volleyballs, and those of us who ask why. And for me, process theology, which is the area that we're talking about, combines both of those. It's speculative. It asks big questions about what is the nature of reality, what is the nature of the cosmos, what is metaphysical. And the other is really grounded deeply in everyday human experience. It's very pragmatic. All the speculation in the world is not worth anything unless it changes behavior and makes a difference to how the world becomes. So that in trying to do theology, I always try to put those two things together, the speculative and the pragmatic, or another term is radical empiricism, that it has to feel good to where people live in everyday life. And if it doesn't feel good in everyday life, that speculation, then you have to call into question. And I think that is a very modern... Postmodern is the term that's used, way of doing things nowadays. That for most people, the two basic questions that they ask it, you know, what difference does it make to my life? And when they're walking out in the mountains and looking over brooks, why? You know, why did this happen? Why are we here? And what of that? And putting those two things together. So when I started to sit down to write this book, I was quite serious when I said that it began in a jazz club. The first parts of it, because I really image God as playing jazz. Now, the metaphor doesn't work if you don't know how jazz works. So for those of you who know jazz, let me go with it for a few minutes so that the metaphor will be more real for others. Jazz is free form. It's improvisation, but it has a history. It comes out of a African slave experience in North America, and out of the slave experience of people yearning for some freedom, and who try to take their past, their tradition, and weave it into the slave experience of the early in the 1700s in the United States. And it became a secret music almost. It was private music. And they took things from their environment and wove them into new ways of being. So they took some old gospel hymns and they sang them in ways that would feel familiar to us today, doing the service last night. But for the oppressors of the time, they didn't know what was happening. So it was that kind of secret improvisation to reclaim their own soul. And so jazz is about soul claiming, and it's about improvisation. And as it went over the time, jazz took many forms, from the blues to freeform jazz, which happens to be my favorite, which means you get a bunch of people in a room and somebody sets up with a kind of a basic melody, and everybody says, okay, let's see what we can do with this. And you may be the piano player, and I always use the piano player because that's one of my favorite. So you play along, and you may take something that's very familiar, and then the guitarist may pick it up and move it into a whole another direction of experience. And I've been at, just before we left California, I was at a nightclub, and the drummer is playing 16-15s. Now try to think about drumming at 16-15s. And the bassist was playing 5/4, which is, you know, we're turning music around when you're doing that. And the guitar player was doing an Odette Coleman improvisation with the saxophonist. And as you sat there, all the boundaries you had created in your head had to be pushed and beyond. And they took a very simple little melody, Mary Had a Little Lamb, and played with that simple melody for 25 minutes until it was on. You would not know that where it had come from and what it was. So my metaphor is that God is playing jazz with the universe. God doesn't know where that tune is going to end up. And God is completely dependent on the other musicians in the room. And whatever they add, God has to include into God's repertoire and to transform that into a new piece of music. So if you image that as your basic understanding of how God works in the world, that's the basic image, the process theology tries to indicate is true about God and about the world. It's true, I think, the world is in an improvisation, that there is not a plan out there in which somebody's tacking things together. There's not a blueprint out there in which things are being put together. But the evolutionary process is seeing how do things fit, and what new ideas, what new images, what new imaginational realities can emerge out of that interaction between people, and between not just people, but all of life. And God is part of that improvisation. God is beginning with simple tunes and offering novel interpretations. Another image I want to throw out on that is, if you take kind of the first chapter of Genesis, and you think about in the beginning when God started to play jazz, there was chaos. And that in the beginning there was chaos means there was something, there was God and something else. So the God that we're talking about in process theology needs something. Now, this is a very crucial and important concept, needing. God has a need for something else. Now, traditional theology has offered us a God who doesn't need the world, who doesn't need us, but may, out of some kind of graciousness, respond to us. But I'm saying speculatively that there is a need in God to be related, and that is God's erotic nature. God is eroticism writ large, seeking to be related to everything that is. So if you take that first chapter of Genesis, God needs a world and begins working with that chaos, which is just primitive or primal order. or disorder, or whatever way you want to imagine that. There is something there in that chaos. It's not emptiness. And that God sits there with that chaos and kind of whispers in the ear of that chaos, hey, how about trying this out? How about trying this way of being? And so that chaos organizes itself into some kind of life form, out of the call of God, out of the desire of God to have a relationship with something. Now, I'm staying with this desire of God to have a relationship. God gets very bored with this kind of primordial ooze, because it's just kind of sitting around saying, oh, you know, oozing around. I mean, it's really kind of boring. Very harmonious, but boring. So God wants a little more intensity in God's experience. So God whispers this, hey, let's improvise with what we've got and see what boundaries can we push. And so this primordial ooze intensifies its own experience. And then we have the beginning of life and the evolutionary process of life. Now, in that very desire of God to have a relationship and to have an intense relationship also creates the possibility of evil. Because there are two important concepts that go with this. There's real freedom. Now, freedom is not, in a lot of ways we've been told, is freedom is derivative. In my book, I speculate that freedom is given to every creature by existence. It's not given by God. Freedom comes with the territory we call this cosmos. So that the most basic element of life has some level of freedom. That is self-determination. So that if the electron, if you will, has some power of determining its future reality. Maybe very minute, maybe very almost non-existent, but it has some power of determination. So freedom is given, which God can't do anything about. God can't take freedom away or give freedom. All God can do is take freedom and say, hey, use freedom in this particular way. God can value up freedom, make it more exciting, more real. Another concept is that creativity is given with the territory. Everything has some element of creativity. And creativity means what normally we mean, is the ability to take something and make it into something new or different. That everything in life has some primordial level of creativity, of taking whatever has been offered to it and changing it into new ways of being. The third thing that's important is what is called pan-experiencing, or Charles Hartshorne used the word pan-psychic, which means that at the most basic level of life, there is experience. Now, take a rock. Rocks and carrots are always hard ones to talk about this to make sense out of them. Take a rock or a carrot. The experience is not in the rock, nor is it in the carrot, but it is in the molecules that make up that entity. So the experience is in the molecules, in the most basic bit of matter that there might be. Now, in human beings or in other animals, the experience is much more complex. So as you move through the types of life forms there are, you get more complexity of experience. So human beings, because we have a self-reflective ability, make our experience much more complex. We value up that basic experiencing. I'll stop for a minute, because I mean, I just threw out a whole bunch of stuff that some people probably have never heard before, and say, okay, you know, where do people want to probe on that?
Seems to me that the whole idea that in fact God is kind of an encourager, someone. The image of whispering of try this is very interesting. In that traditionally we say God made man in his own own image, implying kind of like God was kind of lonely and wanted something. And it's, I want to hear more, but it's interesting to me that that concept, that whole feeling of need, although we don't say it's need, because traditionally it seems to say God needed to find the face of being God.
That's right.
But it's interesting to hear that. And I'm not quite sure how I received that yet, but I want to hear more. So, I mean, that's just my reaction initially. It's very interesting. And the jazz analogy is perfect. Coleman. Why did you pick Coleman? He's I once saw him in concert with a friend of ours who's a singer, and I couldn't, it was like out of control.
Right.
Out of control.
Yeah, right.
And the only time that you get, I used to say, at some juncture, he's going to come back to the ground level somewhere. And he never did.
Right. He never did. Anyway, that's right.
That's
just
my response to what you said so far. I'm not quite sure what I make of it there.
Okay.
Perhaps you could tease out, George, some of the ways in which it contrasts with Orthodox. You mentioned one.
Okay, and that picks up what you're saying, that Orthodox classical theism, supernaturalism, has a God who is self-sufficient. There is no need in God. God is completely, has everything that God needs. Now, that for me, that's a problem. It may not be a problem for other people, but I can't enter into a relationship with someone or something who has no real need of my relationship. I mean, we have friends because our friends give us something that only they can give us. I think all friendship is erotic. So there's a need in friendship. Now, God can be a bigger friend, if you will, if you want to use that image. But it has to have some, I have to make some difference. Now, this may sound very subjective and very self-satisfying, but I think it makes a lot of sense when you tease it out even further, and I hope I can do that. But if God needs the world, God has an investment in the world. Now, classical theology, in the abstraction of God, that is, God is over here, out here, beyond. And in fact, that's one of the terms that classical theology uses, is holy other. Now, the holy other may, out of graciousness, choose to relate to the world. And that is a gift of God. I think it's more powerful if there is an intensity and an erotic desire for God to be engaged, which values up the relationships. I mean, I think we see somebody and we say, hey, you know the old song, Across a Crowded Room? We see somebody, and we have that kind of spark, and we move there, and we engage with that spark, and we sit down there, and 2 o'clock in the morning, everybody's leaving, you're still standing in the corner talking. It's that kind of relationship that I think makes worship serious. That if you have a God who needs you, and who is engaged in your in a deep relationship with you, then what you do matters in the most real sense that you can think of a thing that matters. So what human life does has a determinative quality to whatever will become. Now, if in the classical thing, if God has everything, what we do is maybe important, but may really not matter. Because God can come in at the last reel with the silver bullets and, being the Lone Ranger, save us. The God I'm talking about who needs us to save the universe, the cosmos, the environment. And so I'm pushing this one more step further, that this particular world could be blown up by us, and God can't do anything about that blowing up. God can't rescue us. There's no skyhook God going to throw out a skyhook and pull us back in. But there's a God who's intimately involved in every aspect of life, trying to tease out positive possibilities, richness of experience for all of life. So what we do, the social realities we create matter. I was saying to Scott earlier today that one of the problems Holden Village has, and we don't have it to the same degree, is that you really prove what I'm talking about, because everybody comes into this place and you're getting all their energy, and it's and then they leave and you're full of this energy that you got from being all these people coming in and being part of your experience, and it's made a difference to your life, but you're not always sure what to do with that difference. And that this, the second part of that is the vision of Holden Village then helps you use that energy in ways that is creative rather than destructive. So the vision of being, and I like the analogy that at the Vespers, of being a garden here, helps people take all that interpenetration that you're getting every second of every millisecond of experience, and the vision helps you transform it into some positive and energizing energy rather than debilitating and draining energy.
George, one of the problems from we talk pragmatism, you talk daily life, we have problems as human beings accepting the responsibility of being in relationship with God, period.
Right.
And if you look for a more intense relationship, forget about it. We can't even stay married for more than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So what is this? Take us then, if the view that you're putting forth is a valid view of God and God's relationship to us, then it's very difficult, because in order to have that kind of erotic relationship, it's a two-way street.
Yeah.
We have to fulfill our end of the deal. We can't love Christ half the time, and if we believe that God, in God's grace, presented Christ as a way for us to reach God, then we got a lot of problems trying to deal with God the way he wants it.
Okay. Now, you're right on that. So I start right here on a very pragmatic. Whatever you do is good enough.
Okay. That lets me off.
And it does. It does. Because if everything matters...
Yeah. Then what you do is good enough.
Okay.
That's your definition of grace.
Could be a definition of grace, yeah. The next little level of that is sometimes the good is the enemy of the better. Okay. Sometimes the good is the enemy of the better. That is, we sometimes get too satisfied with the good that we've done.
Absolutely.
And we cut off the intensity and the next level of complexity that we could create, right? So, but if we always begin with whatever we do matters, and it is what we can give. A second part of that, and I've got two thoughts going here at the same time, so I think I can get them both out. The first thought is that what matters, it matters, and it makes a difference. And the second thought is that, and it goes back to the grace, that we're not the only actors in the world. If we live in a relational world, that's one of the things I forgot to say was basic. I mean, we live in a relational world. Everything affects everything. Nothing is unaffected in our world. We're not the only actors then. We can do the best we can and offer that, and we know that other people are doing things. And God has a responsibility here too. God's the kind of the big vacuum cleaner, sucking all this experience up and offering back to us the best of what we've done. And so we're all receiving back from God continuously every moment. So God has a job to do about holding all of the experience, whatever, however big that experience is. A guy wrote a book called The Size of God, and that's the issue. God has to increase in size as the experience of the world increases. And that's God's job. We don't have to do God's job. I don't have to know what's going on in Seattle right at the moment. That's God's job. My job is to be the best I can here. And let the people in Seattle be the best they can. Then we move into the next level, the role of community. That we are in networks of experience. So you have a community here, and Jeanette and Suzanne and Scott and I are in a community through our directorships that expands. All these communities are crucial. You belong to political parties, you belong to churches. All of these things are ways we organize that that experience collectively, to value it up. Then I go back to what I'm saying is that whatever you do is good enough, and that the good can be the enemy of the best. Communities are groups of people who say, hey, shit, you missed that, the boat. No, you can do better than that. Communities are ways of calling us to account for what we've done, and to encourage us, to support us into doing more. Yeah, communities enlarge our vision. And then they can offer a vision which is the best, which also can be the enemy of the good. A lot of us have these big images of how the world ought to be, and that image of how it ought to be sometimes is a negative impact because we never seem quite to get it together to live out that big picture image that we've got floating around in our heads. So that best image, that image of the community, also has to be in transition, has to be in improvisation. Now, I've set a whole bunch of interconnecting points here, and we'll get back to there, and I just want to see if I made it so complex, it's oblique.
Well, what you said is we can never retire.
That's right. That's right. We can never retire.
We can never rest on our laurels.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm still back on the jazz. It's interesting because I once heard an African theologian speak, and he said the difference between African theology and Western theology is that Western theology, African theology takes things in. Like they'll, start at some point, and then they'll hear about something and say, oh, that's kind of cool, we'll take that. Mm-hmm. They'll hear about something else and say, well, that's kind of interesting, and take that. And they're always adding on to their theology, whereas in the West, you're always taking away, mm-hmm. Like this is, that doesn't fit, that's dirty, you throw that out, that's immoral, you throw that out, that's selfish, and you're mm-hmm. always... And he said that's the difference between African theology and Western theology, which sounds like jazz.
It is.
The difference between jazz and classical is that jazz you can add all kinds of stuff. Classical you got to stick with stick with what's printed there. And so I don't know. That's what struck me.
Yeah. Next. Just as an aside, Cornel West has got a new book out called Race Matters. And he has a long section talking about how pragmatically we have to change. It's an American experience, so let me stay with the American experience. We just have some of the same problems in Canada. But until we get back to that issue of race and the uprisings in Los Angeles and understanding what's basically disjointed, that we're not going to be able to solve any of the other major problems. And then he uses the analogy of jazz, of getting a basic melody, and people then doing their thing to add on and change the contours of social experience. And then he goes on to make the very point you've made, which is African theology is a much more inclusive. See, part of the thing that we've European theology really gets. So syncretism is one of those problems where we got to keep our theology pure, And process theology says, hey, conversation is what it's about. Conversation means there's a lot of people involved in the room, and they all have something to say in that conversation. And you walk out of your conversation a different person. I mean, think about the kind of nights you've been up late, and you're sitting around the dinner table, and you've had a great meal, and
with great friends.
And you know, after the sixth bottle of wine.
How many friends?
That's right. You look at your watches and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and you say, "Hey, we're different. We've gone out of the room." That's because we've exposed ourselves in much very intimate ways of letting ideas come into our head that we didn't necessarily want to let come into our head in the beginning. Now, Western theology has this kind of blockage, and you know, you're absolutely right there. Let's kind of bracket it off and get it down and get some orthodoxy here. I mean, only Western Christians have fought about heresies.
At the risk of sounding too orthodox, talk to me about how the redemptive process is worked out in process theology.
Every moment as God is engaged in two activities, redemption and emancipation. Every moment of experience is a redemptive experience. That is, everything that has happened enters into God's experience. And God sorts it out and offers back to us valued up experience. So you do something half good. God takes the half good and hands it back to us as a good. That's the emancipation activity. So I'm saying, in every moment of experience, there's redemption and emancipation. The idea is freed up to work different. Now, Christians have taken that basic idea and have created a myth about it. That is, they talk about a Jesus who somehow died on the cross to redeem us. I personally don't believe that. That's our myth that we use to tell us the story about God's ongoing redemptive activity. What happened, I think, with Jesus is there are three things that happened. Jesus taught stories about God's immediate experience, presence to everybody. You find that in the first levels of Q and hints of it in Mark and Matthew, in which Jesus talked about the kingdom of God being present to you at every moment of experience. That's how close God is, it's like breathing. And that when you take that seriously, that becomes redemptive. You know, and I think what happened is that some early Jesus people took that seriously and they said, yeah, that makes sense. God is at every moment of every breath that we take. And then they created a story about that, which is the story about Jesus the teacher. And then the next level of that was the story of the church, which becomes, Jesus becomes the Messiah for the early church. He becomes the one through the window by whom people see this reality that God is engaged in redemption in every moment of experience. So I understand Jesus as the Christ as a pair of glasses, as a myth, to help us understand God's immediate presence in every moment of experience. You want to say something more about that, or is that? That was very quick. That was three chapters.
What about hell? How does that fit into your scheme?
That was a waste one.
I mean, I think one aspect is that we do know hell. I mean, there's a kind of common sense, pragmatic level of life in which we know that we're screwing up. People look at, I mean, all you have to do is walk down a street in San Francisco or Los Angeles and you see people sleeping in the street. We know deep in our gut that's hell. We've created that reality. Nobody else has created it. We have. I mean, there are people who, the 2% who control the 60% of the wealth of North America, they've had a part to play in it, but we've gone along with it in what Galbraith calls the culture of contentment, we middle class people. So that's partly hell. Now, if you're talking about after death, after death stuff is optional doctrines. But
you can take them or leave them.
You can take them or leave them. If they're going to make a difference, let them make a difference. In other words, for some people, resurrection is an important concept to understand the ultimacy of God's justice. So that the people who sleep on the street will be redeemed in God's presence. And they will experience resurrection that's appropriate. They will experience justice. I mean, that's what I think resurrection is about. I think personally that if I'm resurrected, just the thought of that, you know, you see God for an instance, that'll be sufficient for the rest of eternity. I don't have any bigger need than that, I think. Other people may have a bigger need, that they want a longer eternity of grooving with God. You know, I just want one set.
You don't have a list of questions?
No, I don't. But you may have a list of questions. So I think so there is that resurrection is another metaphor about solving with some sensitivity issues that people have. And it has something to do with justice. Now, I think, and it goes back to your question about what hell, that some of us are going to be able to experience from God's side that which we know we should have done without guilt. I mean, guilt is Protestant, and Catholics are pretty good at it too, but it's a Protestant activity, and so you don't do anything. It's better to feel guilty than to act. So we're going to have that experience of right? It's much better to feel guilty than to change.
Well, maybe that's not true. That's too black. I mean, yeah. It's not that easy sometimes.
Right.
But yeah. That's
not that. So we're going to experience from God's side that which is painful to God. But without that kind of beating myself on the back, kind of, because God is in pain. I mean, this is the other thing about an erotic God. God is, this really matters, Sven.
When Mark writes, of course, Jesus is saying the kingdom is at hand, you feel then that somebody forgot to say that hell is at hand.
Yeah. That's the other side of that. That the experience of the kingdom is the ability to experience that which is incomplete. And the incompleteness is that experience of hell.
What about, I'm giving you an opportunity to tackle all the big ones. What about things like, what about sexuality and morality and that stuff that Christians have worked up with? How does that play in your jazz section?
Yeah. Basically, for a good jazz group to work, they have to trust one another and know that there is a, that when you start to go out on the limit, somebody's going to pick it up. So you have a relationship happening. And you can destroy that relationship by unfaithfulness. Now, unfaithfulness is a cover, cuts across a whole bunch of, doesn't matter who you, what part of your body you put into what other person's part of the body. That's immaterial. It's the quality of the relationship. You know, the part of the answer is, for me, homosexuality is just another way of being sexual. It's not in itself, it's not wrong, just like heterosexuality is not in of itself wrong. But you can act as a heterosexual and homosexual in a way that is destructive. And I think that's the issue. You know, how do we live, and how do we act in such a way that either builds up relationships or tears down relationships? And there are pragmatic levels of that. I mean, you know, living in communities like this, that I worked with a group of people in a small community, and whom you're sleeping with was really a real problem. Because if you had too many people they were too intimate with, it was not the fact you were having intimate sex that was a problem. It was the fact that in the community it just destroyed it, tore it apart. You follow the kind of distinction I'm making? Now, too often the church gets hung up on the act and forgets what really is at stake here, which is the quality of relationships.
George, don't we tend to do that anyway with a lot of things? I mean, getting back to the question, the brother's question about morality, it's like we come out with Plato's perfect table. Mm-hmm. By the time I make one in my basement, it's some piece of junk. I mean, we start out with caring about the quality of relationships, or possibly the quality of life. Mm-hmm. And by the time we filter down so most of us can understand what's going on, we say, don't do X.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of that involved. And how does that play out in your theology? You know, how does a common guy get the message? Don't, you know, we say, well, it's really nice to love one another and have these relationships and this and that. And I'm too dense to know that. So he said, don't do X or do X this way. And makes it simple, theoretically.
Yeah.
Except that your better and good kind of gets involved. How does the world play out?
So yeah, you're raising the question of truth now.
Oh, all right.
Capital T. Is there some abstract, absolute standard out there? From process perspective, no. There is no Plato's table. There is no plan out there. There's no blueprint that tells us what is best and which is worst. We're really improvising that. Okay. Now that sounds, well, everything is relative then. Eh? All morality is relative. Yes, it is in one sense relative. In the sense, in a relational world, you can see the consequences of action. When we're driving down here from Toronto to California through in January, we went through Memphis and Oklahoma and all that. Now, those it's very instructive to drive across the country flipping radio stations. Isn't it? You get a lot of country and western through that area. We had, you know, every channel, country and western, country and western. Now, what struck us about country and western was there is a high degree of people knowing the consequences of action. I mean, they're all worried about what went wrong and how many people that, how many been in the bar too long, and you name it. It was all there as this crying cheating music.
I think that's cheating crying music.
Yeah, okay. that's right. Yeah. And so you go to a movie, and even the most kind of inane movie, sometimes they have the most moralistic ways of picturing it. So you get something like Lethal Dick 1 or Lethal Dick 2, and you have to have you have to have a big problem so that they can go around and kill everybody. You got to justify it. So you have in one of those movies the South African, I mean, I love this one, the South African white apartheid group selling cocaine in the United States to support the right racist regime in South Africa. Now, isn't that a nice enemy to have so you can kill everybody? And so this was the enemy. You know, so we create the enemy so we can kill them morally. Yeah. But the movie did tell us that there are some things that are beyond the pale.
But how can you trust those things? I mean, what's really those things, and then what's conventional wisdom? You know, I mean, conventional wisdom kind of skims the surface of that kind of stuff and holds everybody intact. But how do you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah,
how do you
yeah,
know when you,
yeah.
When you know, what's conventional wisdom and what's truth? Thank you.
Well, I'm saying conventional wisdom is truth, as long as you don't abstract it to absolute truth. Now, I think that's what we do. That's kind of a convoluted way of saying it. I think common sense there is true. There are kind of five basic common sense things we know. You know, you pick up after yourself. You don't hurt one another in kindergarten. You know, the one that was in the kindergarten. It's there. Now, what we do in our society is we take those kind of basic common sense insights, and we then try to absolutize them, and we codify them, and we try to find out ways by which we can then judge people. Now, if we didn't do the latter, then I think we would create an ethical system that we could call one another on the carpet for our activity. But the problem we do is when we do that, we too write it too big. We make it, it's not coming out as clearly as it's in here. We say it's against God's will. And so we've anteed up the issue. If it's God's will, then this person is a real absolute sinner. And then we have to have a whole bunch of ways to redeem that absolute sinner. But if we say, yes, we are sinners, and there's real sin, and what we find, how do we sin originally, we all find original ways to do it. but to write this sin up as if it were against God's will, you follow me up and get it? It's the particularities that we create as if they were against God, this stunk in God's nose, rather than that there is real sin in the world, real evil.
It's also the assumption that we can say how God will respond to that sin.
Right.
You know, what limits God will set to dealing with us as sinners. And we don't have the authority to do that.
Yeah. Now, an illustration of what we're talking about is that when we work with teenagers and we talk about sex, I just tell teenagers it's dumb to have sex before you're a certain age. It's not immoral, it's dumb. You make a distinction because you don't have as much fun. I mean, first of all, they haven't explored their bodies enough. They're not autoerotic enough. And they haven't learned that first part. And so they jump into bed rather than having a relationship. Have you ever noticed teenage groups, when they come together, you can't get them to hug?
No, you can't get them to look at each other's eyes.
Okay, but you can't get them to hug. They A-frame it.
Oh, they A-frame that.
And then they'd rather A-frame rather than look at... We tried this experiment. You have to go around the room and greet one another, look one another in the eye.
Oh, you don't put your bodies together.
Yeah.
You don't really hug somebody.
Oh, that's illegal.
But we did this thing where we have people walk around and you have to look into one another's eyes without touching. That was very hard for that's hard for most of us because that's much more intimate. So I'm my kind of baseline is some things are if you do it too soon it's just dumb. And that goes back to your question of, you know, and your question about standards. Let's, you know, it's dumb to get drunk at 12. It's not immoral, because your body, and you try to explain all the reasons for why it's dumb.
It's dumb to get drunk.
But that's exactly it. You know, you
sometimes.
Try to explain all the reasons,
yeah.
You know, it's dumb, and what you come off with is dumb, don't do it.
Yeah.
And that's easier, and that's that's something that people can hear and you know, for whatever reason, process that a whole lot better.
That's right.
And I mean, just gave a great example, something that I've been sitting here wondering, you know, I mean, I think this is great. Process theology is so incredibly healing. I mean, it's exactly the kind of metaphor change I think that people are just groping for spiritually. But, you know, when push comes to shove, in order to sort of communicate with people, you kind of have to boil it down to something. And a lot of times that's don't do it.
Yeah.
Period.
Right.
Well, but
or whatever it is.
In terms of talking to young people, though, and saying it's dumb because you aren't old enough to know what it's all about yet. And,
but I don't think they can really hear.
Yeah.
Well, except that it's I hope there are young people who will hang on to, will be able to say, yeah, I'm really not ready for that, and say it's not right for me. Not that, you know, I don't want to hear people telling me that it's a sin and it's wrong for me to do that, but that's a more pragmatic reason. And I mean, that is hard because there are a lot of teenagers who think they're ready for whatever's out there.
Well, and even, I mean, that's one example, but I mean, other things too, you know, I mean, older people dealing with kind of the concepts that you've been painting pictures of for us. I mean, it just seems really incredibly difficult, like in a worship setting, let's just say. You know, I mean, there are things that you just do, you know, because that's what worship is about, it's ritual, you know, it's not a process.
I want to come back to that,
Well, I guess what I hear being said is that you can say to kids it's dumb, don't do it, but what you don't do is turn that into an absolute law and say, you know, God will burn you up if you do. You know, it's God's law. That turns it into that kind of an absolute isn't helpful either. You know, it's not helpful to say these are the rules according to God and presume to know that. You know, maybe we just, that's the one slip up, is to say that we know what God is believing to be right and wrong. Because you're right, we should be able to say, you know, to whoever, this isn't good for you as an individual or for you as a group at thus and so age. And we can say those things to one another, but why do we all, you know, why does it always get turned into a rule of the church? And, you know, it gets turned into this, God knows this and God's going to do that. And that doesn't make a lot of sense and isn't really very helpful.
And I've been very involved over my lifetime in certain social causes. I'm a socialist. And I've always been tempted to say it's God's will that everybody ought to be a socialist. But I understand. But you're right, I can't do that. I mean, all I can say is, does this seem to have some appeal? Does this seem to be a better way of living? And let's try it out. But I have too many friends who walk around in the church saying, socialism is God's will, and it turns people off from the pews, and they get alienated. And it's that authoritarianism that the church is very susceptible to that turns us off. All right,
I may want to continue on this line, but I have another question.
Go ahead.
But if we all became process theologians, What would be the rationale for distinctive religious traditions in
America? Okay. the rationale for me, the rationale for distinctive religious systems is that we all have a history. We don't come out of nothing. We don't arrive in this verse ex nihilo. We come out of families. We come out of cultures. We come out of particular parts of North America. And all these things are formative to our identity. And so to come out of a Christian identity is crucial. It's one of the ways that God communicates God's way of being in the world, or our way of being in the world. Christianity is one of the many ways of being religious. I kind of think it's easier for us who were raised in the West to be Christian than Buddhist. And let's pragmatically, let's flow with that tradition rather than trying to jump into something that is much more foreign to us. Am I weaving away? So pragmatically, if God is speaking in a whole bunch of voices, playing a lot of jazz bands, it matters whether or not you're in Nat Coleman or John Coleman. Mm-hmm. Each is a tradition. Miles Davis plays a different kind of jazz than Dizzy. So, and if you form yourself into that kind of, okay, I play in Dizzy's tradition, then you can, you got a whole history that you can draw upon. It's there as a resource to deepen your experience. But if you try to play as if nobody else has ever played.
Or playing all the bands.
Or playing all the bands. Exactly.
And also, if I'm more comfortable worshiping in a particular style,
yeah,
then it's not up to me to tell you that you have to worship the same way. Or approach God the same way that I do.
Mm-hmm. More and more incarnations are looking like jazz bands in one corner and classic.
That's right.
Now, my biggest problem with a lot of what gets said in this country about what we ought to be doing in terms of social issues is that there are a lot of people out there telling me I've got to see it their way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just how I deal with a particular problem in my life may not be the way you would approach it. But that doesn't mean my way is wrong. It doesn't mean your approach is wrong for you. But I have a real problem with you telling me I've got to see it your way.
And I think I want to add an addendum to that. I think there's some pragmatic indicators that we can agree on outside of our particular. It's not just up to each individual. There are some communal indicators of this works better than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, how do you in a jazz band call one another on something that isn't working? Because it's well and good to say, yeah, we all do things differently, or there are all these different styles of jazz, and I don't want to be told, you know, your way is wrong. But the flip side is we can see that there are things going on in our society, in our churches, that are breaking relationships down rather than building them up. And so how do we be critical, or you know, how do we call one another on those unhealthy things? Or in a jazz band, you know, what's the appropriate way to say that thing that you're doing isn't fitting in right now?
I think you've already, in a real sense, named what I call constructive criticism. You're sitting there playing, and now if you're in concert, it's very hard because. But if you're in a practice, you can say, hey, that's not fitting in. The term constructive criticism is very important, which means that you take what a person is doing and you critique them for what they attempted to do, and did they reach their own particular artistic aesthetic goals, and you can push them within their own metaphor. And so you can say, hey, you tried to go really far out on that one, but you just blew it because it was all atonal and discord, and there was nothing but discord here.
George, that implies that one has taken time and energy to understand the other person's metaphor.
That's right.
And unfortunately, it seems to me that we don't have time to make up our own metaphor. We don't know. Yeah. You know? That, that